Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Who Can Sue Whom edition. Thank you for tuning in. On January 19, 2011, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Astra USA versus Santa Clara County. A federal statute requires drug makers who participate in the Medicaid program to enter into contracts with the federal government that limit the prices that companies can charge certain healthcare providers for their drugs. The question in this case is whether the healthcare providers can sue the drug makers for violating those price limitations on the common law theory that drug makers have violated their contract with the government and that the healthcare providers are third-party beneficiaries of that contract, even though the contract was required by statute and the statute does not authorize providers to sue drug makers for violations of the statute. To discuss the case, we have Jeffrey S. Buckholz, who is a partner in the Appellate Practice Group at King & Spalding. Mr. Buckholz worked on an amicus brief in support of the petitioner. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Buckholz.
Hi, this is Jeff Buckholz at King & Spalding to do a podcast on the Astra USA et al. Against Santa Clara County case that was argued in the U.S. Supreme Court on January 19. Before I start, I should say that I worked on an amicus brief in this case in support of the petitioners, the drug companies, for pharma. And so I may be biased, but I'll do my best to provide a dispassionate account of the case for everyone's education. This is a case about a statute known as Section 340B that provides that certain healthcare providers, essentially favored purchasers, known as 340B entities, are entitled to discounts on prescription drugs from manufacturers. This is spending clause legislation. The way it works is manufacturers who decide to participate in federal healthcare programs, as a condition of that participation, have to provide these statutory discounts to 340B entities. The statute implements this program through contracts. The manufacturers who choose to participate enter into pharmaceutical pricing agreements with HHS, and the contracts track the terms of the statute concerning the discounts that are required verbatim. The statute does not give the 340B entities a private right of action to enforce manufacturers' compliance with the statutory discounts. That is undisputed as the case comes to the Supreme Court. The 340B entities that brought this case, led by the County of Santa Clara on behalf of a putative class, argued that it didn't matter that the statute did not give them a right of action, that they could sue for essentially the same relief, bringing essentially the same claim under federal common law as third-party beneficiaries of the contracts between HHS and the drug manufacturers. The Ninth Circuit agreed with the 340B entities' third-party beneficiary theory. The Ninth Circuit said there's no private right of action under the statute, but that's a different question than the federal common law third-party beneficiary theory question. And because HHS has not done enough to enforce the discounted provisions, it would be sensible, in the Ninth Circuit's word, for the court to allow 340B entities to pick up the slack and bring essentially enforcement actions of their own in lieu of HHS enforcement. One striking thing about the Ninth Circuit proceedings was that HHS filed a pretty strongly worded amicus brief that said, we do not view these 340B entities as intended third-party beneficiaries. We never dreamed when we entered into these contracts to implement the statute that 340B entities would be able to bring this kind of a lawsuit. Needless to say, the manufacturers agreed with that, which meant the parties to the contract were taking the position that these were not intended third-party beneficiaries. The striking thing about the Ninth Circuit's decision is that it did not address the HHS amicus brief at all. The HHS amicus brief, I should also add, went on to say that allowing these third-party beneficiary lawsuits would interfere with HHS's administration of the program and result in disuniformity and inefficiency and the like. The manufacturers petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court to hear the case, and the Supreme Court agreed to do so. The manufacturers led with a broad argument that this is essentially a case about implied rights of action, and the case begins and ends with the proposition that the statute does not allow the 340B entities to bring a private right of action, and that it would be an impermissible end run around the jurisprudence regarding private rights of action under statutes to say, oh, well, that doesn't matter because they can bring the same claim through the federal common law as third-party beneficiaries. That's the broad theory that the manufacturers led with. Their narrow theory, their fallback, is that even if, in theory, third-party beneficiary law could be applicable here, these 340B entities are not, they don't meet the common law standard for third-party beneficiaries because the parties to the contract did not intend that they have the right to enforce the contracts, much as HHS had argued in the Ninth Circuit. The manufacturers also echoed HHS's argument that allowing third-party beneficiary lawsuits would result in interference with HHS's uniform administration of the program and inefficiency because of the complexity of the discounted prices and the difficulty of reaching uniform administrative decisions as it is through the HHS process on how the discounts are to be calculated, that all of those problems would be aggravated by allowing potentially 14,000 340B entities to bring an unlimited number of lawsuits all around the country. The United States filed another amicus brief and participated in oral argument. It did not address the broad issue, essentially the issue that third-party beneficiary claim is an impermissible end run around the lack of a statutory right of action. The government did agree with the manufacturers, as it had said in the Ninth Circuit, that the 340B entities were not intended third-party beneficiaries within contract law. And the government also went a step further and said that these pharmaceutical pricing agreements are not actually contracts at all, and therefore can't be enforced, presumably even by the parties to them, let alone third parties. The plaintiff, Santa Clara County, the respondents, put all their emphasis in this case on the contracts themselves and said this is not a case about rights of action to enforce a statute. We're not trying to enforce a statute. We're trying to enforce a contract. Congress, when it passed the statute, directed that this program be implemented through contracts. It didn't have to do that. It could have just made it a regulatory program and not used the mechanism of contracts between HHS and manufacturers. But because Congress chose to use contracts, that means that Congress must have wanted to tap into the well-established common law background of contract law, which includes the well-established proposition that third-party beneficiaries under certain circumstances can bring claims to enforce contracts that were intended to benefit them. And Santa Clara also argued that allowing these kinds of lawsuits would not disrupt the program, that HHS and the manufacturers were wrong or were exaggerating the difficulties that would inhere in allowing third-party beneficiary private enforcement. Justice Kagan was recused from this case because of her involvement when she was Solicitor General, so there were only 8 justices that heard the argument yesterday. The argument, I think it would be fair to say, went well for the petitioners, for the drug manufacturers. Lisa Blatt did the argument for Marlon Porter for the drug manufacturers. David Frederick did the argument for Santa Clara, the respondents, and Ginger Anders from the SG's office did the argument for the United States. One observation about the oral argument is that it shows how radically the court has changed its view of implied rights of action of the law of remedies in federal court. In the old days, the Ninth Circuit's approach was the law. In the old days, the court would ask whether it would make sense, whether it would be good policy to recognize a right of action that was not created by a statute. And the oral argument transcript reflects that those days are past and that there really didn't seem to be any one on the court who was receptive to that notion. And it's striking that, anticipating that reality, that the Respondents' Council did not really even defend the Ninth Circuit's rationale, but rather tried to reconceptualize the case as really only being about contract law. There was some traction at oral argument for the broad theory that this was an end run around the implied rights of action jurisprudence. One striking thing about the oral argument in that regard is that not just the justices on what is popularly referred to as the conservative wing of the court who have been in the forefront of the implied rights of action jurisprudence in the past few decades cutting back on that authority to create private rights of action, not just them, but also Justice Ginsburg seemed to think that this case was, in a meaningful sense, an end run around the lack of a right of action under the statute. She challenged Respondents' Counsel on that point near the end of the argument, and I think it's fair to say that if even Justice Ginsburg is not willing to go along with the respondents on that point, that there is really no way the respondents are going to prevail. The second point I would make about the oral argument is that that said, there were several justices who seemed not interested in or not in agreement with that broad theory, Justice Sotomayor most notably. And it is entirely possible that the court will not address that broad theory and will decide the case instead on narrower grounds having to do with maybe assuming that third-party beneficiary law applies, but holding that under that body of law, in any event, the third-party beneficiary claims here fail because the parties to the contract did not intend third-party beneficiary enforcement, or for a different reason. The government did not get much traction on its position that these are not contracts at all. Maybe the best way to explain that is just to relate an exchange between Petitioner's counsel and Justice Scalia. Petitioner's counsel says, the government says a contract is not a contract, even though it says it's a contract. Our position is that it's a contract. Justice Scalia says, that doesn't make much sense, does it? To laughter all around. And I think that was essentially the way the court viewed the government's position, with some curiosity. Incidentally, the reason the government, I think, is taking the position that these are not contracts at all is because that would mean that presumably even the manufacturers who are parties to them could not enforce them in court against the government. And if you were the government, you might like to be in a situation where nobody could enforce these agreements against you. And so maybe it's not surprising that the government gave that position a shot. The next thing that I would say about the argument is, more so than the briefs, it was striking that there was a lot of interest in the question whether states could sue to enforce similar drug pricing agreements under Medicaid. If the counties that are trying to sue as third-party beneficiaries of the 340B program cannot sue, does that also apply to states, or are states in a different position? There was a lot of discussion of that, and I think that the court does not need to resolve that question in order to decide this case. It could assume that states can sue and hold that because third-party beneficiaries in this case are not sovereigns and it's a different program, that they can't, or it could simply decide not to address the question of whether states can sue one way or the other. Another interesting question that came up at the oral argument is why Congress provided that this program should be implemented through contracts as opposed to simply Congress providing in the statute the conditions that manufacturers had to comply with and or delegating authority to promulgate regulations doing so to HHS. Instead, Congress specifically said that there should be contracts that will implement this program. And again, that was the argument that the respondents made, that Congress in doing so knew that there was a well-established background body of law governing contracts, including third-party beneficiaries, and that Congress meant to tap into that body of law or else it wouldn't have used contracts as the mechanism. And I think the answer at oral argument anyway to that question was that in part it's a historical artifact because there had been contracts between states and drug manufacturers providing for discounts before federal law formalized that arrangement, and in part to assure spending clause clarity, that to assure that manufacturers who participate in this program really are consenting to do so and really are therefore accepting the conditions on their participation. There is a contract they sign that makes that clear, as opposed to potentially relying on some maybe less clear, less explicit regulatory mechanism to satisfy the spending clause. The Supreme Court will decide the case by the end of the term, but there's no way of knowing how quickly between now and then, and I will say that it's always hazardous to predict what the Supreme Court will do just based on oral argument. That said, here, it really did seem like there were a few justices who were inclined to accept the petitioner's broader position, a few more who probably are not, but who may be inclined to accept the narrower position, and it did not seem that there were too many justices who were inclined to accept the respondent's position, and I would say that there didn't really seem to be any justices inclined to accept the government's somewhat more idiosyncratic position.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.